these are great questions. I think. I mean, the only danger is like you're a science fiction geek too, so we may both end up geeking out.
The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
David Auerbach is an American writer with a background in software engineering. He has written on a variety of subjects, including social issues and popular culture, the environment, computer games, and literature. In this episode, we discuss an essay he wrote for the Daily Beast in September of this year, entitled The Sci-Fi Roots of the Far Right. It's Wednesday, December 13th, 2017, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. I want to remind you that we've moved the Inside Zero Books podcast from the Zero Books blog to Patreon. This will make it easier to get the members-only podcast on podcatchers. It also means that we'll be repeating the first year of Inside Zero Books daily on our Patreon account. Well, not really daily. I've been doing it when I remember. But anyway, if you've missed the Inside Zero Books podcast the first time and you want to hear old episodes, they will be available, if more sporadically than I'd like. I want to urge you to pick up Anselm Japes' The Writing on the Wall, Philip Cunliffe's Lenin Lives, and the first book in a new line of books from Zero. It's called Neglected and Misunderstood, introducing Theodore Adorno. The Neglected and Misunderstood series presents philosophers of the left that are either a little known or widely misread. Stuart Walton starts the series with a book on Adorno, and Adorno's been blamed for everything, from the Beatles to postmodernism, and he's been widely misread. The music you're listening to right now is the finale from the film The Quiet Earth. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to David Auerbach discuss sci-fi utopias.
So much of politics is, or ideally so much of politics is, you know, putting up your vision of future against someone else's and saying, this is what I think the future should look like. The other person saying, "Are you out of your mind? That future shouldn't look like this. It should look like this." And this has a tradition, I think, across the political spectrum. I think it starts with Plato's Republic. You know, the Republic is an exercise in science fiction. Certainly, the utopia presented, the city of the guardians in the Republic, is a projection of a certain type of political system in the future. And that inaugurates the tradition of utopia, which eventually gets melded in the industrial age with a certain vision of scientific and technological advancement and gives us forward-thinking utopian science fiction. And as we know, utopians are a very paradoxical lot, because at the same time as they're hoping to make things better, they're also willing to frequently do very terrible things in pursuit of that goal.
Look, I feel like I'm probably more on the utopian side of politics than you are. Correct me if I'm wrong here, but I kind of tend towards more of the Marxist, you know, let's change the system fundamentally, kind of radical break side of politics. And that's what animates me, is this vision of a world which is both better but also remarkably different than the world we live in today. And
I think I'm animated by that too, I think. I wish for it. Maybe it's a question of...
Well, like, here's what comes to mind. First of all, I just want to name the piece that you wrote. It's called The Sci-Fi Roots of the Far Right. And when I was thinking about this morning, about your piece and how science fiction can be, you know, it sort of has a radical edge in it from the start. It's always envisioning a new kind of future, a society that's very different than our own. And that can have a reactionary component to it, which is what you explore in your piece, is that the, you know, change utopian future can be a negative utopia depending on your values, right? I mean, and a white ethnostate is a utopia from the perspective of a Nazi. there's also a strain, I think, in science fiction since the 70s, which is more pessimistic and muted and maybe anti-humanist, and which I associate with the new wave.
Yeah, yeah.
And which, it, you know, a good example was not a new wave writer, but I think a paragon of this approach would be Ursula Le Guin.
Really?
Yes, because she wrote one book called The Lathe of Heaven, which is all about the dangers in utopian thinking and the will to power that's behind it.
But at the same time, I think she also offers a very positive vision of potential futures in books like The Dispossessed. And I, from my perspective, I actually see The Lathe of Heaven as something of an outlier in her work relative to some of the others. And I guess when I think of Le Guin, I do think of her as being certainly a kinder and more and sunnier writer than some of the really brutal new wave writers, where you will never see even the possibility of a happy future, and where I think failure, catastrophe is even built into technology and humanity. And I feel like you see that in J.G. Ballard in particular, but also in someone like Joanna Russ or perhaps James Tiptree. I think some debate then too, because Le Guin has been criticized, I think, for going the shiny, happy people holding hands route a bit too much. I think she was criticized by Thomas Dish in particular, and Dish is, I think, one of the most inveterate pessimists among science fiction writers. I adore Dish's writing, but I certainly would never say that he is anything but a pessimist, especially next to someone like Le Guin or Samuel Delaney. I mean, Delaney is a new wave writer, but despite, I think, his immense criticism of systems of oppression that exist today, I think he holds out a tremendous utopian hope for a system that can recognize difference and marginalization. So I think the new wave certainly came about in answer to the somewhat cookie cutter utopias that were being proposed by what we think of as golden age science fiction writers. And some of those were left wing utopias, some of them were right wing utopias. And that raises the question, I think, of exactly what constitutes left-wing and right-wing. Is a left-wing utopia a right-wing utopia that minus the racism? Exactly what qualifies as what? Because most of them relied on something approximating managed economies, controlled economies. So there's a way in which you could say, oh, they were all left-wing. Some of them were just racist. So there's that question, too, which is that the goalposts have moved in terms of what we would call left-wing, what we would call right-wing. And many of the Golden Age science fiction writers, however, not Heinlein, who started off as left-wing but then moved considerably right, but someone like Isaac Asimov, C.M. Kornbluth, were classic socialist left-wingers, but they were elitists, and they were not exactly what we would call conscious of intersectionality. So I find another great use of science fiction to be figuring out both the similarities and the contradictions in these positions being put forward. That it's easy to think of right-wing and left-wing and define them strictly in terms of, oh, well, Republicans today believe this, Democrats today believe that. But if you extend it into the future, you have to deal with new issues, and you can wonder, okay, well, what exactly is a left-wing position vis-a-vis such and such a future?
Yeah, well, I do think it's worth wondering about. Just to speak briefly about Ursula Le Guin and say, Asimov, I would put them both in the camp of being progressive writers, which means rather than being true through and through socialist writers who try to envision a society which is deeply different or radically different from our own. They are more intersectional. Certainly, now Asimov isn't intersectional, but Le Guin is. But they're more incremental in the kinds of changes that they seek. Now, when it comes to Asimov, my problem is I have not read deeply with Asimov. I've read Nightfall and a few of his short stories, but my understanding of his persona is that, you know, he believes in the scientific progress and the improvement of humanity, and he's an atheist and dedicated towards that end. But I don't know of anything about his supposed socialism. Le Guin, I feel like, yes, there are books like The Dispossessed, and there was The Left Hand of Darkness, which try to envision a different kinds of society. The Dispossessed is one in which, if I'm remembering correctly, that's one where a man encounters a alien race of genderless people.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And that was a remarkable feminist text of its time and stands up today. I don't think that it's truly utopian, but I do think it's radical in terms of its gender politics.
I think that's fair. Yeah.
So utopian vision is one where you step, like, I don't know, someone like Olaf Stapleton or, you know, where you're really trying to step back and talk about the transformations of humanity in total rather than some particular social ill within the moment of today. That's really an impossible thing for anyone to do successfully, but I kind of think like visions of intergalactic travel, radical transformation of our bodies, different kinds of economic systems, all of these things are more fundamental to utopian writing than issue-oriented fiction. But I also think that after the New Wave, none of that stuff felt radical or leftist anymore. All of it felt sort of authoritarian and conformist.
I feel like you're raising a lot of very significant issues, and I'm not going to be able to rise to them, because I think that there is a, in some ways, this is exactly what science fiction is supposed to do, is to raise these definitional questions of, you know, what is progressive, what is social change. With Isaac Asimov, have you read Foundation?
I read the Foundation. That's like a trilogy of books, or even
more. Yeah.
And I read some of the Foundation trilogy, but I was like 12. It's been so long, I don't remember very much about the books.
It's worth a reread. It's simply because it's so fundamental in terms of establishing what the Golden Age vision was, and that sort of techno optimism and I would say socialist vision. But more significantly, and this is something that came up when I was speaking to Newt Gingrich, because Gingrich said that I mentioned a lot of right-wing authors and things like that, but it was Asimov that he fixed on. And I thought this was very interesting, because Asimov does not share Gingrich's politics. But what Foundation offered him was this vision of what Foundation terms psychohistory, the idea that that there are patterns of history a la Toynbee or Spengler that can be identified and used to predict the shifts of history and identify when empires will die. And because Foundation was heavily influenced by the vision set forth in Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, this appealed to Gingrich's own background in history. And if you read Gingrich's visions, they are predicated on a certain idea that, well, America needs to change to survive, and we need to go forward on this vision. And but the thing is, what Foundation pretty much sets forth is a dying empire, a la the remote Roman Republic, and the initiative of one brilliant man, Harry Seldon, who figures out that the empire is going to die and needs something to replace it and sets up the plan, a plan to establish a new galactic government that will supersede the empire and ensure the continuation and success of humanity. And that's the Foundation. And the Foundation is, I guess, what we would call a reasonably happy socialist, you know, project, but it is no doubt heavily elitist. It is authoritarian to the extent that any galactic government is going to have to be authoritarian, and that everybody is swearing fealty to a small government. And this is something that you see in Golden Age fiction all the time, which is that you have some huge intergalactic government, and somehow it's actually holding together and is capable of being administered. And I think part of the problem, part of the criticism of these Golden Age visions is no one ever explains how this is going to be done. And as that gets teased out, I think you start to see it developing in more right-wing directions, with people like Heinlein pretty much saying, well, okay, we're just going to have some gigantic emperor who's ruling over it with an iron hand. And that's what turns it from a vague socialist paradise into a vague authoritarian or even totalitarian paradise. And that's, I think, one of the most interesting elisions that happens, which is that to what extent can you set out some positive view for the future of the humanity and ensure something like human rights, civil rights, autonomy, and all these other things that we might term issues. And if you're willing to throw all those out the window, the difference, I think, between the left-wing and the right-wing visions often collapses kind of quickly. And there's so many examples that I could cite, and I'll bring up one or two as we get to them. But it's so interesting. Like, you know, Frank Herbert's Dune seems, in my opinion, like a very right-wing portrait of the future. But at the same time, Herbert seems skeptical of the sort of totalitarian government he puts forth. Yet there doesn't seem to be any gestures towards a more positive left-wing politics or a more positive politics of any sort. So is it just fatalism? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, have you read Barry Malzberg's book Beyond Apollo?
Yes. Yeah. Speaking of cynicism.
The novel I will write about the ultimate truth of the voyage will be divided into small chapters, each of which will recapture some aspect of my past or present life, some part of the captain or the program. I will use the short chapter format because I do not have the patience for long chapters, and because I believe that what happened can be indicated only in small flashes of light. Tiny apertures which, like periscopes, will illuminate some speck of an overall situation so large that none of us can comprehend it. Parts of it will be true, and some of it will be only as I conceive it. But in totality, it will make the final statement about the Venus program and about myself.
I mean, that's the thing, is that Malzberg is the canonical new wave writer who basically says everything that went before me is garbage. Are you kidding me? The space program's a joke. I'll show you exactly how hollow your dreams are. You know, he makes J.G. Ballard look like, like a wig, yeah, like Asimov. That Malzberg is going to show you exactly how awful everything is, and that I think became sort of the caricature of the new wave, with them pissing all over every possible dream of scientific advancement. I mean, that's President Ballard as well, but you know, not all of the new wave was quite that pessimistic.
Yeah, but Malzberg is one of my absolute favorite writers, and I love him as someone who's on the left. And I don't actually think he's really of the left, by the way.
Really? Oh, I think he is.
Look, it depends on what you mean by the left. Do you know about the scandals around Malzberg in the last decade?
Tell me which ones.
It's just about stuff he wrote for the Cephal Bulletin, I don't know, 7-8 years ago, I think.
No, I don't know this. No.
He wrote along with Michael, I forget the other guy's name, but he wrote this piece about an editor from the 50s and 60s of a science fiction magazine. She was one of the first women editors in the science fiction world.
Judith Merrill?
I don't think it was. I can look it up. But anyway, he called her, you know, a lady editor, and in the piece talked about how all the wives of the science fiction writers were, you know, unhappy that she was there and you know, concerned about their husbands and all that kind of thing. And, you know, they just were, the two of them were relating. I think it was Michael Resnick, actually, and Malzberg.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just kind of relating stories from that era. And it cost, you know, they got called out as being terrible misogynists, and the heads rolled at CEFWA, and Malzberg was talking about, you know, these lefty Marxist Nazis, or, you know, that kind of weird talk. And
oh, well, I mean, the thing is, if you start saying that sexism is a disqualifier for the left, you won't have any left.
Right. Well, I don't happen to think that his piece was fundamentally sexist, right? And I think that it was a mountain out of a molehill. But I do think that he didn't think of him, wouldn't have thought of himself as, say, a straight ahead socialist. Liberal? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Democrat? Probably.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I may be guilty of conflation here simply because next to someone like Jerry Pournelle, next to Heinlein,
right,
next to those who I think of as sort of intrinsically putting forth a right-wing vision of the future, Malzberg certainly comes off as someone of the left liberal persuasion. Now, within that wide swath, there's obviously been increasing divisions, and we can talk about how this affects the left in general these days, but certainly, you had happy Republicans like Frank, well, or unhappy Republicans like Frank Herbert, who certainly, you know, weren't even part of these struggles on the left.
In the early days of science fiction, like in Asimov's time, there was a strong socialist contingency in the pulps. And along with that, around that same time, there was a right-wing faction that came up alongside them, right after them. And I think Malzberg wasn't part of either of those worlds. I mean, he was coming after both all of those guys, right? And he was, I think, a literary writer with literary ambitions, who was a liberal, and who would have probably described himself as relatively apolitical in comparison to these, you know, hacks all around him.
Well, I guess, you know,
He's still alive, by the way. He might be writing, for all I know. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think because of what he was writing, I guess it was inevitable that he would be classified with the leftist tendencies of the new wave, and the leftist that he was being read and talked about by people like Joanna Russ and Norman Spinrad, right, who very much is left wing,
right,
and all of these people are very much creatures of the liberal left,
right.
And I guess what I would say is he was part of an intra-leftist discourse, because the right wing simply looked at this stuff and just threw it away.
Right.
Because they were just like, whatever. We've got, you know, we want our Starship Trooper. What the hell is this nonsense?
Well, it's worth noting that Gingrich would have nothing. There would be nothing in Malzberg's work for someone like Newt Gingrich.
Right. Exactly. That's exactly the point that I'm making. Yeah. That's exactly how to sum it up. That Gingrich wants future histories showing the triumph of humanity and how that happens, and, you know, how capitalist does it need to be versus authoritarian? and apparently it needs to be very capitalist and very authoritarian. But if you're going to talk about the psychological consequences of the neuroses of the space programs, that's not going to interest them at all. So I feel that Malzberg is a subversive writer, let's say. And to the extent that subversion is a very important part of the left, I guess I see him as affinitized with them. But calling him a socialist, you're right. You know, that may not be justified next to someone like China Mieville, who I think was part of the British Socialist Workers Party until they had that huge schism. But that Mieville is an avowed, I think, Marxist. And though he's been very willing to criticize the ideas, but he does it from within that perspective, and he has very strong, explicit political convictions, rather than being, I guess, somewhat of a more ironic literary person like Malzberg.
Yeah, I mean, after the revolution, someone like Malzberg would probably be worried about going to the gulag.
We all. I hope you're worried, Doug. I mean, I've read some of your stuff, and you're in a big trouble.
Okay, I'm a little worried about it.
I've seen your Facebook posts. You know, there's enough there to be confessing to those till the end of time.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I figure Zizek will protect me from.
Yeah, I was reading about that book you published, "Kill All Normies." It's apparently like quite a reactionary work. I think that's enough to get you like put on the gibbet right there.
This is right there. This is why I need to take power after the revolution.
So. That's right. Exactly. And this is where we could connect with the right wing fishes. It's all a question. If a left winger wants to take power, it's a left wing utopia. If a right winger wants to take power, it's a utopia.
That's right. Right. Yeah. Okay. So, but this is important. Back to Malzberg, in the 70s, with the new wave and with Malzberg as our kind of icon here, this critique of techno optimism was.
Can I ask you a question? How many people read Malzberg these days? Because I didn't know about this scandal, and I mean, I read him years ago, and I really just thought that no one read him anymore.
I could not guess how many people. I don't care. Like, he's one of my favorites. I'm just going to talk about him. But yeah, no, I don't know. He's not that popular a writer anymore. And
I found out about him from, I think, Kathy Bull, who recommended Galaxies, which is a hilarious. You've read Galaxies?
Yes, I have. Yeah.
It's a hilarious book because it's about it starts off as a standard Malzberg gloomy thing, and then it's cut back to a Malzberg surrogate who's complaining about how awful it is to be writing this book.
Right. He wrote another one called Hurwitz World, and he wrote a bunch of metafictional stuff. You know, I think almost all of his work has sort of that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And when I was trying to write and try to write science fiction, a friend of mine gave me his nonfiction book called Engines of the Night, which is all about how the limitations of science fiction and how science fiction will never really become a literary genre and that kind of thing.
Dish, sounds like Malzberg.
Yeah, and Dish did something very similar a little later on, about 10 years later or so. But my feeling about Malzberg and the new wave in general is that it was a very necessary critique of techno-optimism that they put forward, and that there was a radical quality to their work.
Yeah. Oh, and we should add that one of the most important figures, and one who I think is especially underrated in America in particular, is Michael Moorcock.
Yeah, Michael Moorcock.
His influence simply in organizing and fostering the entire new wave is, I think, underrated, possibly because he wrote so much and some of it was not great. He apparently was known for writing a book in a week.
Yes, right. And Malzberg was similar kind of character. But no, you're right. Michael Moorcock is another one who I've read some of and quite admire, but I haven't read his Sword and Sorcery, you know, quickly churned out work. So all of these guys were important, and they were mostly guys, I think.
But, oh, yeah, yeah.
But they were important in,
which is an important point. I want to speak. The gender thing is actually incredibly important because I think a lot of the fissures that developed and a lot of the most interesting developments came from the rise of women into science fiction and what they brought. And there are, and I think you still see an underrating of incredible figures like Joanna Russ, James Tiptree, Carol M. Schwiller. Carol M. Schwiller is incredibly underrated. She's amazing. And the funny thing is, I think she got her first exposure through Harlan Ellison's Dangerous Visions, or that was her first sort of break. And Ellison is another one of those people who was classically identified as a hard leftist, liberal socialist, but who is now thought of as some sort of reactionary. And I think he is another model of sort of how things have shifted. Now, doing something like grabbing another science
Connie
fiction.
Willis.
Yeah, you're grabbing Connie Willis' breast on stage is guaranteed, I think, to cause you that sort of problem. So, I'm not exactly saying pity poor Harlan here, but it is fascinating to see that you have this person who supposedly is a liberal paragon, and look where things end up. And I think that a lot of those sorts of issues have a lot to do with how views of science fiction and how the politics within the field have evolved. Because you shouldn't be acting like that, right?
Yeah, I just think in the terms of literary aims, that the new wave and even Ellison's version of it with Dangerous Visions, all of that opens up critiques that might be, we'll call today, intersectional, that are that step back from grand narratives, that look a little bit more microscopically at the world as it is, that zoom in on the individual and his or her psychology. Domesticated science fiction, all of that stuff comes out of kind of after the new wave critique of techno-optimism and kind of grand humanistic narratives.
Well, you did have someone like Clifford Simak, who is writing, human-scale science fiction, even in the Golden Age. There were or someone like Jack Vance, who I think is very underrated, who really dealt with, I think, cultural differentiation and alternative cultures. But as you say, these were not representative of what was identified with the genre. I think that in some way you do see their influence subtly in the new wave, that in fact some of these aspects were already present prior to that, but the new wave centered them and said, okay, we're going to focus on this and see exactly how badly they can untangle the supposed ideals of our golden age.
I'm not saying, I mean, obviously there were kind of, I would just call them more literary oriented writers in the golden age, and a little after. Lafferty would be one.
Lafferty stands by himself. That is also an incredible right winger, but he stands by Ari Lafferty. Mm-hmm. I adore him. I think he's one of a great American writer. He is also a right wing Catholic. You wouldn't necessarily know that from reading a lot of his work.
Right.
He criticized the Lord of the Rings for being anti-Christian, which I think Tolkien would have been very surprised to hear.
Well, I'm just looking at Lafferty as someone who strikes me just through his absurdity as being writing a little more psychologically complex stories.
I don't even know how to classify Lafferty. You know, one of his first novels was called Past Master, and it was about a race of aliens that resurrect Thomas More, the author of Utopia, to create a utopia for their planet. And unsurprisingly, Moore ends up getting killed again. So Lafferty certainly has, I think, a strain of Christian pessimism, saying, well, do not believe in science, do not believe in man, only believe in God. But it's so masked through the bizarreness of his material that it becomes very difficult to gauge exactly where he stands without knowing that he happened to be a hard right Catholic.
Okay, well, so, if you're going to call someone like Malzberg psychologically more complex than someone like Asimov's, the reason you're going to do that is because of his pessimism.
Is that necessarily true?
I think so.
Because I think of Samuel Delaney as emotionally more complex than Asimov, but I do not think of Delaney as a pessimistic writer, ultimately.
No, I'm just saying if you're going to call Malzberg that. I didn't say every writer who is psychologically complex is a pessimist, but I'm saying if someone like Malzberg is going to be thought of as writing more psychologically complex characters, the reason is not really because of the length of his descriptions or the complexity of his relationships or the depth of his prose, but some more that he is willing to like write at the aim at the contradiction within people, aim at the dark, expose the dark side of people. He's a pessimist.
He certainly is. Yeah. Does it make it more? I guess it makes it more, even more politically complex, perhaps.
Yes. It makes it more politically complex. It makes the work seem more mature and less juvenile because of.
Well, not to my father. My father hates Malzberg and loves Asimov, so he'd disagree with you. But I think, to us, it makes it look more.
To me,
sophisticated.
Yeah. I mean, at a certain level, I guess I'm just talking about taste. But what I'm aiming at trying to get at here is just to say. Malzberg, though, could never, if you're a socialist, an actual socialist, Malzberg's never going to give you a vision that you can build any kind of future society on. He's only got critiques.
Certainly. I hear what you're saying there. And I agree.
And I think the New Wave in general basically had the same characteristic. I mean, and cyberpunk, to agree, was also constrained, maybe a little less so, by the same sensibility of critique, for critique and without any vision of something beyond it.
I would actually say that it's probably more true of cyberpunk than it is of the New Wave, because I will put up something like Joanna Russ's The Female Man as genuinely putting forward at least possibility. Same with Samuel Delaney, that there were people who wanted to say there is another way, but it's not the way that the Golden Age has shown us. With cyberpunk, though, there's almost a movement away from, I think, politics qua politics and towards a certain portrayal of the future as style, the future as fashion. And at that point, I do feel that you're getting away from the postulation of, you're not trying. It's like going to a Dashiell Hammett book and saying, well, what vision of the future or what vision of the present does this portray? The politics are there, but it's not the goal. It's not necessarily coherent. What's coherent is a certain affect, a certain style.
Yeah. Well, I mean, my question is, to what degree has the left in science fiction handed off these utopian visions to the right? That's my question. And I guess it goes beyond just asking it of science fiction writers. I mean, why is techno-optimists in Silicon Valley, none of them are Marxists? I mean, other than the fact that they're billionaires and they couldn't be. But, I mean, why isn't there any sort of Marxist wing of techno-optimism that has any?
Well, there is, isn't there? I mean, I think who is Aaron Swartz? Maybe he wasn't Marxist, but Aaron Swartz was certainly a believer in a transformative movement, and I believe Schwartz would have identified as a socialist at least, and certainly a believer in fairly radical leftist politics. I feel that if you're looking for someone who, at the same time though, I think China Mieville does fit your definition.
You think so?
Pretty well.
Yeah.
I think so. I think that while he is far from an unvarnished optimist, I read Mieville and find in him someone who's a lot more hopeful than I am, I think, at least in the near term. So I think these figures exist, but in some ways the hold that science fiction had in our imagination is now suffused through all of pop culture. So if you're seeing science fiction in a watered down commercialized version, when you watch Transformers on the big screen, that's going to swamp out the voice of someone like Mieville, who's writing for a much smaller audience and writing for an audience that is much more versed in the tropes. I think another writer who qualifies is Ian Banks. who put forward, I think, a robust socialist vision in his culture novels that is unabashedly sort of a Scottish socialist, which is what he himself identified as. And ironically, Beggs said that he didn't think humans could get to it. He thought human nature was too rotten to allow this to happen, but he didn't. But he wanted to portray a socialist utopia that at least was possible for some creatures to attain.
Inside its warship body, in narrow, unlit, unheated, hard vacuum spaces, constructor drones struggled to install or complete sensors, displacers, field generators, shield disruptors, laser fields, plasma chambers, warhead magazines, maneuvering units, repair systems, and the thousands of other major and minor components required to make a functional warship. Gradually, as it swept through the vast open reaches between the star systems, the vessel's internal structure changed, and it became less chaotic, more ordered, as the factory drones completed their tasks. Several tens of hours out on its first journey, while it was testing its track scanner by focusing back along the route it had taken, the ship registered a single massive annihilation explosion deep behind it, where the factory craft had been. It watched the blossoming shell of radiation expand for a while, then switched the scanner field to dead ahead and pushed yet more power through its already overloaded engines.
Do you think that it's possible to distinguish between right and left in science fiction and to not despair that the right has grabbed hold of our utopian visions for the future?
The point that I was making in my piece, unfortunately, is that in terms of having a solid political impact, I think that the right did have a tremendous advantage in the 70s and 80s. And this was a result of Cornell in particular, but also an entire string of right-wing science fiction writers like Larry Niven, Jerry Pornell, and some lesser known folks getting a hook into the government, partly via people like Newt Gingrich. And it was through them that we got the Star Wars, the Strategic Defense Initiative, SDI, and this vision that we would shoot down nukes from outer space with lasers. Mm-hmm. And that became sort of identified with the right-wing path to utopia, which is a strong America exercising an empire that is effectively an imperial vision. But it's the good side of imperialism. And while, you know, obviously on the left, imperialism isn't up for debate, you still see defenses, light defenses of British imperialism coming out in various places, saying, well, yeah, it wasn't a great idea, but, you know, this whole white man's burden idea is still fine by me. And I think that's also a component of the right-wing vision, that the best need to lead the rest. And the degree to which the best are of one race colors how much racism you see in these visions.
Do you think that a unified humanity, the vision of a unified humanity exploring outer space, always necessarily has an imperialist component to it?
No. I mean, I think Samuel Delaney's done it. And if someone wants to mount the argument that Samuel Delaney is imperialist, they can. But I'm going to say
well, what
that.
What about Roddenberry? You know, to go pop culture, you know, TV, Star Trek. Do you think that it has a imperialist?
Yeah, I'd say so. What would you say? I think it's sort of undeniable.
What makes Delaney's not imperialist?
Because Delaney is so attentive, I think, to exactly those issues that are raised by the issues of control, power, and human organization. That for him, he is always calling attention to the marginalized. And that focus on the marginal is, I think, at least one marker of a leftist vision. That if you aren't focusing on the marginal, at least to the extent of being concerned of who they are, how they are, if you're just sloughing them off and saying, well, there'll always be some garbage on the edges of society, but who cares?
But in Roddenberry's vision, there is no marginal. right?
How much more right wing can you get? You say,
well,
there won't be any. We'll fix them all. You know, and that idea of fixing humanity is ironically something, of course, that Lenin is said to have said. But the classic Leninist vision does envision fixing humanity. At that point, you can say, okay, well, are we moving towards the right wing then? If we're saying, well, we've got some broken people and we need to fix them. Doug, you know, whatever it is that caused you to publish Kill All Normies, we're going to get into your head and make sure you don't do that again. And then if we won't kill you, we'll fix you. So,
that's nice.
And that gets... You know. and there's debates around, well, what, how are we going to fix people? Are we going to make them nicer? Are we going to make them all the same? Are we going to make some of them? Are we going to respect their natural talents? So,
the idea of a socialist society or a communist society really is one in which there's no marginal, not because there's no one who is bad, but because there's no one who is dispossessed to such a degree that they're on the margins of society, that everyone has some sort of at least ground floor equality in power. I mean,
right. And I would say that Delaney, while acknowledging that such differentials are inevitable, still attempts to portray in something like Stars in My Pocket Like Grains of Sand a world, a universe in which these problems have been resolved to a much greater extent than they have in our age, and that we have people that we would think of as marginal who enjoy a much greater degree of freedom and autonomy than they do in today's society.
Right, and in Star Trek, that's what I would call all. Everyone's like in the military, and that's how it's fixed. It's like no one's marginal, but there are ensigns, and
right,
basically, yeah.
And that gets back to, well, if the vision's vague enough, you can get away with sort of eliding these issues and saying, well, it'll all be great. So it's true that, you know, it's funny. I actually, my wife had never seen the Mirror, the Mirror Universe episode of the original series. So I showed it to her and she was cracking up. But it's funny because there you have, it's almost a claim to say, like, look, you know, of course we're a socialist utopia. Look what else it could be. It could be the evil empire that like oppresses races. So there's always something you can do to say, look, you know, we could be a lot more right wing than we are. And I think that the more unabashedly right wing visions come in when you start saying, well, yeah, of course, people are going to be killed and oppressed en masse. And that's just the way it is. And my utopia has people killed and oppressed en masse. And I suppose some left-wing utopias have that too, but you know, I certainly think of it as that sort of hard-edged realpolitik as being another marker of the left, of the right. Whoa, there's a slip right there.
These days, who knows?
You know, well, no, but I mean, you know, Lenin type of thing. And of course, you know, we're gonna. Those kulaks, we got to get rid of them. Yeah.
Right. So
I'm going to get in such trouble. All the de-kulakizers are going to come
after you for sure. So Jerry Pournelle, he died right before your essay was published.
Yes.
Did that give you pause?
Well, he died. He died a few weeks after it was written. So
right, but before it was published, but after it was written,
yeah.
Right?
It did, and. And I caught flack from a couple right wingers. Glenn Reynolds came after me for it and said that I was insulting the dead. And I thought about it and I said, you know, if I were to pull it or delay it, what would Jerry Pournelle say? He would say, "You pathetic leftist cream puff. This is why you'll never win. You're not even willing to publish an essay criticizing my ideas just because I'm dead. What is it? You have to show more respect for my ideas because I'm dead? Because you certainly didn't respect them while I was alive. You pathetic moron." And I was like, "Yeah, you're right. Publish it. Who cares?" You know?